When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
So bright, pull your hat down, make sure your cinch is tight. Horse is kinda snuffy, cold chill up your spine. It'll get your ass moving, sun will burn on daylight.
Howdy there, I'm Matt McKinley, and we're burning daylight. Welcome to Burning Daylight, the only podcast for the working cowboy.
Well, howdy there, daylight burners. Happy Monday. Hope the weekend treated you well. Welcome back to another expedition, not the word I'm looking for either. Episode. This episode's going to be an expedition into the world of agriculture. This is the Friggin' Farm Report for Monday, December 11th, 2023. We'll go ahead and jump into it with the market report. This is from National Beef Wire, Rob Cook compiling it. This is a Friday p.m. CME Livestock Exchange. Live cattle up 320 at 165.725. Feeder cattle up $5.25 to $215.30, and hogs up $120 at $68.975. Corn was down $2.50 at $4.855, I guess. Soybeans down $7.25 at $13.23. Wheat's down $10.50, $6.3175. And cotton's down 115 at 81.44. Dow, NASDAQ, S&P all closed up higher based on economic optimism. I'm not sure where this economic optimism is coming from, but stocks ended up closing the week higher. Crude oil is up 199 at 71.33 a barrel. Heating oil to 258.5. Natural gas was down a touch at 255.4. Box beef down 183 at 288.01. Select, that was choice box beef at down 183 at 288.01. Select beef was down 93 at 257.90, with the choice select spread being at $30.11. 167 loads on Friday compared to 218 on Thursday. Cattle, live cattle trade in the Texas Panhandle for Friday, and Nebraska and the Western Corn Belt negotiated cash trade has been limited on light demand. In Kansas, cash trade has been at a standstill. Most recent live FOB purchases in the Southern Plains were Wednesday at 171. In Nebraska, same thing was Wednesday from 170 to 171, mostly at 171, with dress delivered purchases from 267 to 271. Western Corn Belt, it was Wednesday, 169 to 171, with dress purchases traded mostly at 270. And I don't think the cattle on feed numbers have come out yet for December, so when they do, I will keep you posted. I like that layout better. All right. Drought monitor. Drought improves in the south and southeast. Some of the eastern regions, Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina missed out for the most part. Abundant rain, precipitation in Hawaii and the Northwest. Pretty well status quo for the rest of the country. As of December 5th, 28.85% of the U.S. was under drought. And, yeah, that's, I guess, of the lower 48, though, 34.36%. So, it's better, but this is, as we're going into El Nino, I imagine you'll see, at least throughout the West, you'll see these drought numbers improve some. But trying to predict the weather is pretty tough to do. I would recommend checking out the Farmer's Almanac for next year, see what's going on there. That's what I'll be doing. And anyway, we'll monitor that. Exports. Wow, net sales of 200 metric tons for 2023, a marketing year low. We're down 98% from the previous week through a four-week average. Increases for Japan and Mexico and China. Those were decreases, so... So they were up 7% from previous week, but down 2% from the four-week average. Okay. Anyway, beef exports are down, it looks like, total. And comments from Dr. Andrew Griffiths says, cow slaughter and heifer slaughter have continued at a rapid pace, which means the beef cow herd and heifers held for cow replacement are going to be extremely low to begin 2024 compared to 2023. Knowing there will be fewer cows and bred heifers means the 2024 calf crop is going to be an anemic number compared to 2023, where production expectations stand at this point for beef cattle in 2024. It has set the market up to support strong prices through the end of 2026. So we're going to have another lowest cow herd inventory since the 60s for 2024. But I mean, supply and demand. So less supply means higher prices on the demand side. So cattle slaughter, weekly reported cattle slaughter was at 635,000 head compared to the same last week and about 648,000 last year. Year to date is 30.46 million head, down from 4.7% last year. All right, well, not a great outlook from the cattle markets and whatnot, but there's some, I would think there's some hope on the horizon. I'll come to this article first. I'm going to jump ahead because China is now to significantly step up grain purchases from the U.S. Soft red winter wheat sales to China have more than quadrupled as the world's top agricultural importer embarks on a commodity buying spree to supplement rain-damaged crops. China's commodity buying spree could provide a needed boost to the U.S. wheat exporters, who have seen their market shrink over the last decade due to uncompetitive prices, a trade war, and stiff competition from Australia, Canada, and Europe. Wheat imports from Australia are down 27% so far this trade year compared to last year when the country made up 60% of purchases. Steep decline is opening the door to trading partners that have traditionally provided only small volumes. After net zero exports from Kazakhstan last year, for example, China's resumed large purchases from the country. Additionally, China lifted restrictions on Russian wheat last year, and imports have soared to nearly a record in just 4 months. Sales to China have also improved market prospects for the wheat industry in the U.S., where exporters were expecting sales to hit a 52-year low. Soft red winter wheat sales to China more than quadrupled from the same period last year. The increased demand has benefited prices, with U.S. quotes for soft red winter wheat raising $17 since November to $273 a ton. Prices for hard winter wheat climbed to $294 a ton, $5 increase that also reflects increased sales to China. China's frenzied pace of imports puts it on the path to exceed a tariff rate quota of 9.36 million tons by a significant margin. Once the quota passed, importers will need to pay even more in tariffs for the commodities needed to fulfill demand. Although China surpassed the threshold in 21 and 22, this is the first calendar year that countries expected to import over 10 million tons since 1995. Apparently, they had some really heavy rains that wiped out a ton of crops, and they got 1.5 billion people or so to feed, so they're scrambling and they're buying all the wheat they can, it sounds like, which is good for American farmers if they got the wheat. Not all bad news, I suppose, but and this one I found pretty interesting. We'll see what comes of it, but at least somebody's talking about it within the ag industry. So lowering crop insurance subsidies for large farms could save millions, watchdog finds. U.S. government spent billions of dollars in 2022 to provide crop insurance subsidies to some of the country's richest farmers, according to a GAO report released last Monday. So Government Accountability Office. Crop insurance soared to $17.3 billion last year, U.S. data shows. The 19 policyholders with the largest premium subsidies received around $3 million each, including a nursery in the southern U.S. that was awarded $7.7 million. Farms with large insurance policies make up just 2% of the crop insurance program, yet they accounted for 36% of subsidies covering premium costs. A 15% percentage point reduction in subsidies for large policyholders would have saved the government around $15 million last year, the GAO found. Congressional leaders have searched for new funding to boost programs in the upcoming farm bill, and some Democrats are pushing to revamp the USDA's crop insurance program as a way to free up more money. This GAO report shows that a shocking proportion of subsidies intended to support the cost of writing crop insurance policies for all farmers are being eat up by companies and agents who write policies for the very largest farms. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, who requested the GAO report in 2021, said in a statement. Booker's office added that crop insurance reform could fund programs that actually benefit farmers in the next farm bill. So this guy sounds like he's most of the rural community, agricultural producers are by and large pretty conservative type people. And I don't mean politically, I just mean in general, their lifestyle is fairly conservative. Therefore, they tend to vote fairly conservative, mostly Republican. Anyway, Cory Booker's is a very liberal. I don't know if you'd call him quite a progressive type. But he's very much like a lefty liberal Democrat from New Jersey, which from being from New Jersey, just kind of like your standard Democrat from there, I would think. Maybe he's also like rumored to be gay. So he's more on the left wing side of the Democratic Party, I'd think. But he's not like full AOC or Ilhan Omar or anything like that. And he says some stuff every now and then that sound pretty good to agricultural producers until you hear him talk at length, and then you're like, oh, so you're not really wanting to save money. You're just it's all about like taking the money from these people who are richer and giving it to these people who are not as rich. And it's all wealth redistribution bullshit. And so while his heart may be in the right place, his solutions are retarded, kind of in the same vein as Bernie Sanders. But us folks here in agriculture need to find some allies pretty well wherever we can, and get support from possibly left-wing politicians, but not allow them to dictate the policies that you want pushed through. You know, you want their support to get what you want passed through. You don't want them throwing poison pills in to kill it, and then nothing gets done. Or sometimes maybe that's the best thing. But in this case, where they're actually the Government Accountability Office is like, hey, here's where we can clean up some of this subsidy issue. Like, I'm okay with that. Let's do that. And when you look at these giant corporate farms that have bought up most of Middle America, I'm okay with them having to pay more. You know that, or not getting subsidized as hard. They make a ton of money, and they've essentially vertically integrated the farming system, where, you know, a John Deere dealership owns a huge farm that they can, have an entire fleet straight from the John Deere factory go to this farm, and they got their own mechanics, and that's what you have to, because John Deere doesn't allow you to work on your own equipment anymore, which should be changing. I know they've lost a couple lawsuits over that, where they have to allow other parties to do the mechanicking on these new tractors. So anyways, it's but it's a whole messy, nasty, just gross corporate situation that has encompassed agriculture in the past 30, 40 years or whatever. And we talk about a lot on the from the beef side of things. We talk a lot about the poultry and the hog industry, but we don't talk too much about the plant side of agriculture, the farming side, and how vertically integrated that thing is too. So it's a wild system, and any meager, you know, improvement is a good thing. So hopefully this catches some steam. But to explain a little bit more, farmers buy crop insurance policies to cover financial losses for price declines or extreme weather events. While private companies sell the policies, the U.S. government subsidizes insurers' administrative expenses in addition to covering the majority of the premiums. So the insurance agent sells you this premium, this insurance policy, and the government pays for most of the premium that gets paid out on these insurance policies, and then they also pay all the administrative costs for the private company. And it's a gross system. I can't tell you the number of times I've heard farmers like almost praying that they didn't have to harvest their crop because they just wanted to collect that insurance premium. Crop insurance costs sort of a whopping $7.9 billion from 21 to 22, USDA reported. Unlike other farm programs, producers can receive crop insurance subsidies regardless of income level. About 0.3% of all crop insurance policyholders are considered high income and make up around 0.5% of total premiums. So it doesn't seem like you're really going to solve that much. If they only make up half a percent, so... I don't know. I'll be right back. Okay, we're back again. Beyond lowering subsidies for high-income farmers, the GAO found the U.S. government could also find significant savings by adjusting the insurance program's rate of return. Insurers received an annual rate of return on retained premiums of 16.8% on average from 2011 through 2022, exceeding a market-based return of 10.2%. Adjusting the program's rate of return to more closely reflect market conditions could save the federal government hundreds of millions of dollars per year, the GAO said in the report. Any changes to the crop insurance program would require legislation from Congress, which sets the subsidy rates. The Farm Bill prevents the government from renegotiating agreements that would reduce underwriting gains for insurance companies, a provision that would need to be repealed. So, essentially, how that works is, since the government's backing up most of the premium and they're paying the office expenses, all the administrative expenses, getting paid by me and you through the government. And these insurance companies, they compete on the market by offering the best rate of return, and they're able to offer 6% above market rate. Because they're not paying out much of anything. They're just like a middleman for taxpayer money. And it's a good job. Not going to lie, it's a pretty good job. But it's kind of gross when you think about it. Like, you're just... you're not even a real company, essentially. Like, because the government backs up all of your... like your insurance premium. So it's just like you're just essentially another government entity, which is, I don't know. I think you guys know how I feel about the government entities. But anyways, it's it'll be interesting to see if anything comes of this. I would venture to guess no, because it's too good of money for everybody involved, except for the taxpayer. Here this week, was the COP28 summit over in, I think it was in the UAE. So it was big climate summit or whatever. And so this headline here, U.S. agencies unveil collaborative food waste prevention strategy at COP28. U.S. EPA Administrator Michael Regan announced the draft national strategy for reducing food loss and waste and recycling organics on Saturday at the COP28, the annual climate conference. The strategy takes a whole-of-government approach to improve circularity for organics, whatever the hell that means. Pulling together research and existing funding for opportunities from the EPA, U.S. Department of Agriculture and Food and Drug Administration, and it's designed to help the agencies meet their joint goal of reducing food loss and waste by 50% by 2030. The Biden-Harris administration plans to make use of existing programs that have already begun doling out resources for organics infrastructure, like the Solid Waste Infrastructure for Recycling Grant Program and Recycling Education and Outreach Grant Program. Other programs like the USDA's composting and food waste reduction agreement will also be harnessed for the strategy's objectives. Federal agencies have been working toward their 50% food waste reduction goal since 2015. In recent years, the Biden administration has continued to work by building up a body of research on the harms of landfilled organics and the benefits that come from rerouting food from loss and disposal. So landfilled organics, it'd be a carbon-based product buried in the landfill. Now, if you remember from some of my previous farm and ranch reports, the part of the idea between regenerative agriculture is to put the carbon back in the soil to be, you know, to help build up your topsoil and everything. And I guess that's supposed to be a better use of the carbon for the environment or something. But here we are. Now they're saying that's a bad thing because it's in a landfill. But doesn't that sound like compost? Like when you bury a bunch of food waste and it gets hot, and like it all decomposes, it gets pretty nasty. But then it makes compost, which you put on your garden or your farm fields, and it makes excellent fertilizer and helps create a better topsoil. And I don't know what the issue is. Like, seems like burying food waste, like if you can't get rid of it through, you know, feeding it to something else, burying it for compost is probably the next best bet, I'd think. But they're saying this is a bad thing. So in October, the agency released a study finding that 58% of methane emissions from landfills comes from organics, including yard and food waste. It determined that most of those emissions occur in the first few years organics are landfilled, often before gas capture systems are installed. The issue of landfill-filled food is also growing. The EPA found that 62.5 million tons of food was landfilled in 2020, double the total in 1990. Meanwhile, the administration released a national strategy on hunger, nutrition, and health last year that included a goal to reduce barriers to food recovery. The strategy cited USDA research finding that one-third of all food in the U.S. goes uneaten, and set deliverables to reduce that waste, including the development of the food loss strategy. Well, I'm sure they've got a great strategy. But a third of all food, if that's even close to accurate, that's disgusting. We're such a fat and ancient nation. It's awful. I don't know about all you guys. I'm kind of been on this, on a fitness kick here lately, and I'm going to continue it because I feel good. And so it's good to be able to keep up with my kids, and they're just going to get faster and stronger. And I'm got to work harder to stay not fat. So I'm going to do that, but I'm thinking about doing carnivore diet for the month of January, just to see how I do and how it feels. and it's just a month, and it might be awesome. I don't know, but I'm going to try it. Anybody wants to join in with me, let me know. We might make a group or something for it and post some ideas or whatever. And if anybody's done it before, hit me up and what your tips are. I'm not going to do a strict carnivore. I'm going to use I'm going to eat peppers and onions and stuff. And then I still use my OptiGreens 50 from First Form. Great company, by the way. Really make really great health supplements and just a good company. Check them out. firstform.com/burnindaylight. Free shipping on orders over $75. They got their holiday flavors out now. It's all peppermint based, peppermint bark, protein powder, peppermint mocha on the collagen, which you can put in your coffee. Great stuff. Highly recommend it. And you should try it. There's a lot of easy things you can do to improve like your gut health and just overall health by just taking a few supplements. And then you start eating right and working out a little bit better, and then you're really cooking with fire. But that's a topic for another show. Food loss and waste poses a real challenge to agriculture, food, and the climate. In order to tackle this program and in turn build a resilient food system and mitigate climate impacts, we must explore and implement innovative solutions, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said in a statement. This joint effort between the USDA, EPA, and FDA will enhance interagency coordination and represents a vital step towards preventing food loss and waste, increasing organic waste recycling, and promoting economic opportunity. There was another... like I said, the further you read into these things, it sounds really good. Yeah, we need to cut back on our food waste. The strategy notes that the current organics recycling infrastructure nationwide is insufficient to address the issue of waste and endorses the use of funding from programs like EPA's Swiffer Grant Program, funded by the bipartisan infrastructure law, to improve that infrastructure. Strategy also makes special mention of the need to build out such infrastructure in historically disadvantaged communities, noting that grant funding should go to such projects as part of the administration's Justice 40 initiatives. So, of course, you gotta put the social justice stuff in all of this, in all of the legislation. The agency said they were committed to researching barriers to decentralized community composting. So that's, they were committed to researching barriers to decentralized community composting. If you would just go to the communities and be like, hey, you could make a community compost pile, and it'd be a good thing, and I bet you it'd just happen. Like, they'd do it on their own. Maybe they didn't have the idea, but you could just remove all the barriers and be like, hey, go do it. That's one way. As part of their efforts, the agencies plan to continue supporting anaerobic digestion via grants and loans to agricultural producers, water resource recovery facilities, and municipalities. Programs that fund such projects include the USDA's Rural Energy for America program, which provides both loan guarantees and grants to agricultural producers and rural small businesses, and EPA's AgStar program. USDA plans to invest $30 million over the next 3 years into its composting and food waste production cooperative agreement program, which helps local governments and private sector partners develop municipal compost plans and food waste reduction plans per the strategy. I don't know why we need the federal government to do any of that. Included in the draft are a number of research and data measures to better track food loss and waste. Among those are the development of a decision support tool to help local governments identify appropriate circular solutions, and a newly announced strategy to better monitor landfill methane emissions. This will build on USDA's Center for Research, Behavioral Economics, and Extension on Food Loss, Waste, and Waste Center, a $1.5 million research program to address inefficiencies in the food system. So they're spending $1.5 million for a research program to address inefficiencies in the food systems. They won't address any of them, or they'll write a report and nothing will get done. So it'll be $1.5 million to do nothing. Food loss strategy also noted the agency's ongoing work with food waste nonprofit ReFed, which announced its own national pack this week with grocers, food manufacturers, and others to track their food loss waste and data, food loss and waste data. Moving forward, data and measurements will be reported in the administration's annual report on the environment, which the strategy authors will allow agencies to become proactive rather than reactive in addressing food loss and waste. I don't want the government becoming proactive on anything, because government agencies rarely know what the fuck they're doing. And all of this, what was that? A number of research and data measures to better track food loss and waste. Well, the biggest consumption of food would be at the in your household. Therefore, the greatest food waste and lost would be in the individual household. So, just another way to track what you're doing at all times. And this time it'll be in the name of preventing food waste. And then we'll have food waste. We'll have to combat food waste, misinformation, and disinformation. And then we'll have to monitor, you know, like every time you repost a food porn picture, you know, of like some just delicious, ungodly, unhealthy burger that they, you know, it's got like 19 different add-on ingredients that you just want to make sex in your mouth with it. But, you know, it's probably going to kill you at some point. Like, if you post that, you get a ding on your credit score, because that's going to lead to food waste at some point, and that's bad. Now, check back in on in a couple years after they've implemented this policy and see how correct I was. I'll be happy to admit if I was wrong. But anyway, I don't see this being a good thing whatsoever. And then moving on to the rest of the COP28 stuff. Sum it up, it's a giant circle jerk of who can be the best little climate dude on Earth. And so they're all talking about how they're gonna ramp up their efforts to cut down emissions and invest more in regenerative farming and climate friendly this, climate friendly that, and we're all gonna do our part to make these fuckers eat bugs. And then, so this is kind of a follow-up on, I don't remember if it was last week or week before, but Tyson's insect bet will spur further adoption in the space, an IFT member says. Protein producers adopting bugs for use in animal feed provides a lower barrier for entry, potentially making it easier to introduce insects into consumer diets, experts say. I wonder who these experts are. While the prospect of eating food insects sounds unacceptable to many consumers, industry leaders see significant promise in their ability to help meet the need for a more sustainable supply chain and more protein. Alexandra Kazex, PhD in RD, member of the nutrition division at the Institute of Food Technologists, said the entry of Tyson Foods into the insect space lends its legitimacy. The meat giant recently announced a strategic investment with the startup Protix to boost insect ingredients for use in the food supply chain, specifically for use in animal feed. Despite Tyson not investing in insects for use in human food, Kazakh says it comes as industry players are taking the prospect of implementing bugs into the food system seriously, and scaling up production can help it meet that demand. Insect farming, she said, currently lacks the infrastructure for widespread adoption. The space can also help solve costly issues, she said, including feedstock availability, disease management, and environmental sustainability. Tyson's interest in insect ingredients as an extension of their existing business is a clear indication of the potential that this market holds, Kazakh said. As food and beverage companies work to overhaul their supply chains to reduce their carbon footprint over the next decade, implementing insect protein into their operations could drive down their use of resources. 8 square meters of land are needed to grow a pound of crickets compared to 115 square meters needed for a pound of beef, producer Cricket Powder said. Yeah, but nobody's dying to eat a pound of crickets. Like, nobody's, like, paying good money to go out to a nice restaurant and eat a pound of crickets. Not that I'm aware of. But every day, people will pay good money to go eat a pound of beef. According to the IFT expert, companies starting with using insects as animal feed could provide fewer barriers for entry into the space with lower costs. By starting with animal feed, companies can gain experience, refine their methods, and develop more efficient production processes before expanding into the potentially larger and more competitive human food market. While insect protein is gaining steam in the West, it's really not. They're pushing it hard, but it's not. As an ingredient, it is still met with skepticism and an ick factor from many as an actual food source. Consumers who are unfamiliar with the use of insects as a protein source may take a while to be convinced based on their association with bugs with disease and disgust. But as consumers increasingly seek out protein in their food and beverage items, insects provide a new frontier. Cricket flour, for example, contains between 12 and 20 grams of protein per 100 gram serving. Kazakh said producers should tailor insect-based products by emphasizing their positive attributes, even if they don't align with their taste and texture preferences. This could include labels explaining nutritional benefits, such as protein content, and vitamins and minerals they contain, along with the sanitary conditions edible insects are raised in compared to conventional livestock, she said. To address this unfamiliarity, it would be helpful to introduce insect-based products in a way that is not intimidating and emphasizes their nutritional benefits, their potential as versatile, inconspicuous ingredients in food products. Adventurous eaters looking for new protein sources are the most likely consumers to try new products made with insects. I doubt that. They're more likely to go hunt something and eat that. Future insect-based products could include dietary supplements, flavor enhancers, powders, bars, and burger patties, according to Kazakhs. Get your cricket burger. It's good for you, kids. Similar to other alternative protein products, producers also stand to benefit from stressing how much less carbon and water it takes to produce edible insects than livestock, she said. As the food industry continues to evolve, insect proteins, as well as plant-based and cell-based alternatives, represent a promising and sustainable alternative that deserves attention and investment. I respectfully disagree, Dr. Kazakhs. Only the poorest of Indian tribes ever ate bugs. As soon as they were able to, they went hunting. Or they grew their own, like, bugs, consuming bugs is a sign of poverty, has been throughout humanity. And there is no need for it. And if, like I said, if you think industrial agriculture is bad, feedlots, chicken farms, just wait until you see an industrial capacity cricket farm. Like, that is gonna, I mean, blah. Gives me the heebie-jeebies just thinking about it. And as far as on the animal feed side, I've thought about this quite a bit. I don't think it's a good idea to feed it to cattle. Because cattle are herbivores. Now, poultry, chickens will eat the fuck out of a cricket. So putting cricket powder as opposed to corn, maybe that's not a bad idea. Maybe that's a little closer to what a chicken normally would eat is bugs. So I'm not opposed to that. However, you won't find me eating a cricket burger anytime soon unless there is some real money behind it. So we'll end on a couple stories of just idiocy. One thing I forgot to mention at this COP28 deal is The United Nations Climate Change Conference led to the launch of the Dairy Methane Action Alliance, an effort to reduce methane emissions on dairy farms. And several dairy companies like the Bell Group, Dan One, General Mills, Kraft Heinz, Lactalis USA, and Nestle are joining forces to both measure methane emissions and be transparent about them. So, yeah, I don't know what all that means. It's a lot of grandstanding. Okay, here we go. So Canada is going to war on plastic. Canada has proposed something drastic. Cutting the plastic. Plastic from produce packaging, that is. Environment and Climate Change Canada published a pre-proposal in August that would regulate packaging in Canada's grocery stores. By 2026, 75% of fresh produce sold in Canada must be sold in bulk or non-plastic packaging. By 2028, this requirement rises to 95%. The Canadian government is adamant, even though plastic packaging for produce only accounts for 2.9% of total plastic packaging in the country, according to Western Growers and the Canadian Produce Marketing Association. Banning the produce industry from using plastic materials at this time would create catastrophic financial and health concerns, or consequences for Canadians, the Canadian Produce Marketing Association President Ron Lemaire and the Western Growers President and CEO Dave Puglia. In case you missed it, food prices in Canada are already high. This is from Magnetic Ag, by the way. The majority of produce sold in Canada is imported from the U.S., and nearly all this produce is packaged in plastic to keep costs down, produce fresh, and avoid food safety and spoilage issues. The crippling reality is that while many would love an earth with less plastic, the price for change could be passed down to consumers. And if consumers have to sacrifice produce, they'll also sacrifice their health. Rural and remote communities would suffer the most. Opponents to the proposal are urging Prime Minister Trudeau and Environment and Climate Change Canada to focus on higher recycled content approach and to better the recycling system. So with all the problems that are, you know, facing Canadians, the government really taking bold action and getting rid of like the cling wrap plastic on your bell peppers. Really, really making a difference in this crazy world. Really going the extra mile. And then on that note here, NCBA member testifies in support of the Black Vulture Relief Act. So this is like still one of the NCBA's like main focuses of legislation at the federal level is Black Vulture Relief and trying to make it so that producers can get rid of vultures if they're poaching their cattle. I understand that. What I don't understand is with the shambles that the cattle industry is in right now, like with the crunch of inflation, drought, the consolidation of the meatpacking industry, forcing the small ranchers out of business at an alarming rate. The small feedlot operators are almost all gone with an increasing concentration of and merging of alliances between the packers and the dairy industry and this huge influx of crossbred dairy calves, putting more pressure on your traditional cattle producer. They're going to focus on turkey vultures, essentially. That is their what they're championing. That is the cause that we should be able to shoot turkey vultures with impunity, which I agree with. I do agree with that. But what you could do anyways is just shoot the sons of bitches if they're poaching a calf and then ask for forgiveness later, or just don't tell anybody about it. I won't say that I've done that before, but I've thought about it a time or two, and I might have blacked out and, you know, stuff happened. I don't recall, but you couldn't get behind the Prime Act, which would empower local producers, local meat processors to sell product retail across state lines with a state inspection rather than USDA inspection, which would create huge amounts of competition at local levels and eventually help cut into the market share of these giant meat processors. But no, let's make sure we can shoot some turkey vultures. And as if the ranchers aren't already taking care of that problem. Like, if you're that much of a rule follower that you're just willing to sacrifice a calf so that you don't get a visit from the EPA or whatever, I mean, use a little bit of resiliency and just take care of the damn problem. It's your calf, take care of it. But you wonder why the NCBA wonders why everybody hates them. Like, why none of the cattle producers are that I know anyway, I mean, there's a handful, but like most of them, even the NCBA members are like, I don't know. They're just like another extension of the government. We elect them to do a job and they just do what they want anyways. And it ends up fucking us over downstream. And yet but I know plenty of ranchers that still pay dues to this trade association that, well, one day they're going to make sure that you can shoot those turkey vultures with impunity, just like you could, a little Tweety bird. One of these days that's going to happen. And you know what? It'll be all worth it for them in CBA membership fees. But until then, you have to be careful about thinning out your turkey vulture problem. You got to get creative. Got a little shifty. And you got to be quiet about that shit. Don't go running your mouth. Loose lips sink ships or something like that. I believe that was Ben Franklin. He said that when he was plowing out some member of the French aristocracy. Probably before noon. To end the show, shout out to Ben Franklin. The dude invented daylight savings times as a gag to talk shit on the French for being lazy while he banged all the women of the French aristocracy pretty well with impunity. So he was the best president that America never had, in my opinion. And so hats off to Ben Franklin today on Monday, December 11th, 2023. This has been the Friggin' Farm Report. Hope you all have a good week. Take care out there. Get your Christmas shopping done. Shop locally. And by locally, I mean small businesses. You can buy it from all the way across the country, but keep money circulating in small communities, whether that be a community within a big city or just a small town somewhere. But keep your money local. And like I said, by local, I mean within small businesses, within small communities, wherever they may be. There's plenty, if you're buying tack or whatever, there are so many good tack makers out there, and they're pretty easy to find nowadays, thanks to social media. So, check that out. If you're looking to get a head start on your New Year's resolution, get back in shape, head over to firstform.com/burningdaylight. Check out their app. They got a lot of good fitness programs and help you track your diet, all that good stuff. And their supplements are second to none. Check them out. And yeah, have a good week. Move your ass. We're burning daylight.
Up in the morning, beneath the stars so bright. Pull your hat down, make sure your cinch is tight. Horse is kinda snuffy, cold chill up your spine. We'll get your ass moving, sun, we're burning daylight. Burning daylight. Burning daylight. In the saddle till the job's done right. Burning daylight. Well, life is just a gather, and you won't catch them all. But when you ride through the gate, make sure you sit up tall. I can see the horizon, it's looking pretty bright. Well, get your ass moving, sun, you're burning daylight.